Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're talking about vouchers. In particular, the ways that vouchers have changed over time, some of the origins of the ideas, the implications for diversity, inclusion, and access in schools, and some ways for stakeholders who love their K-12 public schools to be able to push back against some of the recent voucher legislation and Supreme Court decisions. In the first part of this month's podcast, we interview Dr. Chris Lubienski from the University of Indiana, Bloomington. Dr. Lubienski is an expert on school vouchers and the use of research in informing voucher policy. So for listeners who may not be familiar, what are the key arguments in favor of K-12 school vouchers, and how have these arguments evolved over time?
Yeah, I can go on for hours on that one in particular. It has evolved over the years. I mean, you can go back to the beginning of the Republic, and Tom Paine wrote about vouchers. He was speaking more about, he expected that idea to be taken up in England, but it was much more of a kind of a market failure idea that on public education is important. They hadn't developed that system yet, but he recognized a lot of families wouldn't be able to afford education out of their own pockets. So he proposed basically a system of public subsidies. But so the idea goes way back. And there are some precedents in the U.S. Some of the northeastern states have had, I guess you could call them voucher systems for over 100 years, what they call town tuitioning, where it's more a matter of convenience that public schools weren't evenly distributed across the population. And some towns had private schools, so the state would pay private schools to take the local public school kids. But those weren't really, it wasn't really about choice and competition as the current voucher idea is. So really, most people point back to Milton Friedman in the 1950s. He published a somewhat obscure essay that later got republished in an important book that he did. And he was really much more interested in rolling back the state, just finding ways of redefining public education. I mean, education of the public rather than by the state. So that was, I would say, kind of the original impetus for the policies in the U.S. is more from it was argued from a libertarian perspective, at least from the intellectual author. If you follow the idea, I mean, Friedman wrote that at the time that we were starting to see the civil rights movement have some successes, and he recognized that you were going to see some white Southern segregationists use that idea to avoid integration in Southern schools. He acknowledged that, and he was correct. So you started to see proposals for voucher programs as a way to allow white families to send their kids to private schools in the South at state expense to avoid integrated schools. But there was actually some equity arguments as well. Some leftists and liberals in the 60s and 70s toyed with the idea as a way to give equitable educational opportunities to disadvantaged children. So they played with the idea, but really it didn't get launched until the 1990s. In the U.S. with experimental programs in Milwaukee and then Cleveland. And there the argument really was more about achievement, that vouchers were a way to give those kids access to better education. So the assumption was private schools were better. But since about 2015, all the larger scale voucher evaluations, statewide voucher evaluations, have shown large negative impacts for students using vouchers. I mean, these are really sizable relative declines in their performance. So that old argument about, well, they do no harm is really out the window. So as you might suspect, the justifications have changed again. Joe Moline and Jameson Brewer and I have talked about this as far as moving the goalposts. You know, they really held up achievement as being the reason to have vouchers. And as that started to turn negative, they're starting to change the argument to say that, well, it's really about other issues such as attainment, that is like graduation rates or college attendance rates, which again, that evidence is mixed as well. Or increasingly it's like, well, vouchers allow families choices. And so that should be an end in and of itself.
It's interesting to hear you describe sort of the evolution and the rhetoric that's involved in advocating for voucher programs, because on the public school side, we could say that over the last 40 years, accountability has become the thing. Like, public schools are blamed for everything. They're always failing. They should be held more accountable. So critics contend that K-12 school programs aren't held to that same kind of accountability, which I think it aligns with the description that you're giving. So what safeguards, if any, are in place to ensure that the money that goes to private schools through these voucher programs is used efficiently or effectively?
Yeah, well, you're right that they're not held to the same accountability and transparency standards, and that's by design. That the argument is that more deregulation makes the private schools better. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of evidence to suggest private schools aren't better, including some of the recent voucher studies when you look at those relative to earlier research. But nonetheless, that's kind of the assumption, and that they don't have a lot of regulations, and so they're going to get better outcomes. And, you know, their test scores might be higher, but they're also dealing with different populations. That becomes a problem for families and for researchers and policymakers when we don't have, for example, testing data to know how are these schools performing compared to maybe, demographically comparable public schools, which are tested. You know, so policymakers are putting money into these programs without really knowing if they're quote unquote working, because they're not necessarily administering the same tests, if any tests. Families are having to make educated guesses about whether or not, you know, one school is higher performing than another one. So this becomes an issue, but like I say, you know, intentionally baked into the DNA of these voucher programs, they're not held to the same standards. And this also becomes an issue with, you know, in terms of policies and procedures. For example, admissions, are schools accepting vouchers, are they required to take all applicants like public schools are? And this becomes an issue then as far as are they serving, you know, a representative cross-section of the students, or are they serving kind of a selective group of students that they've selected to, you know, either protect their reputation or their test scores or their character as they describe it.
So I want to go back to a point that you made in response to the first question, which was that some of the voucher advocates are kind of saying, well, it was never really about achievement. That was just to kind of get the story going. And today it's more about choice. You know, you have people with different preferences, and they should be allowed to choose the kind of school and the kind of curriculum that their child is going to be exposed to. So there's some concern now about increased segregation, increased divisions in society, where students choose schools that align with their backgrounds and beliefs. Is there a way for voucher programs to be designed such that they address these issues, or in other words, that they promote inclusivity and diversity in schools, or if we continue down the current path that we're on, are we going to kind of end up with a school system that is just splintered and divided along these different beliefs?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it goes back to the original idea behind public schooling in the US, which was the common school ideal that, you know, people from different backgrounds are going to be educated together. And so it wasn't just a matter of teaching, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. It was also teaching people to live in a republic, social cohesion, tolerance, that type of thing. And we're certainly living in a more polarized time. I mean, I think this gets to the larger issue of school choice policies, not just vouchers. Can school choice be configured in a way that that increases equity and increases social cohesion and tolerance and integration, frankly? So I think there's a couple of things to think about with regard to that. As you're pointing out, there's the issue of self-segregation. Are families going to choose schools with student composition that looks a lot like their own child, you know, whether that's racial or ethnic or social class or religious beliefs? And there is some evidence that families tend to do that. They're, you know, they look for places where their child is going to be more socially comfortable, for example. Where, you know, it reflects the community that they come from. And this is not just a matter of white flight. There's also some evidence of minority self-segregation as well. That becomes an issue. And so your question gets at, can we work with that and find ways of having more integrated schools? So that's one consideration. But the other consideration is how schools respond to this more competitive environment. If a student can take their voucher and go to another school elsewhere, it creates kind of competitive conditions where schools will get more money if they bring in more students. So they're trying to attract more students, and there's different ways that they might compete, you know, in terms of the program they offer, in terms of marketing. So this becomes an issue that schools seem to recognize that there's incentives, and oftentimes they play on people's perceptions of the preferring exclusive environments for their children. For better, for worse, there is evidence, especially in marketing materials, that some schools play on these things. Some work I've done in other contexts suggests that schools market in ways that play on parents' misperceptions about what's happening in schools, and try and pitch the idea of a safer environment or a higher performing school, even though it's just a wealthier school, or serving wealthier kids, and that does contribute to more segregation. So there's been efforts to use choice policies to target equity. And there's ways you could do that. For example, you could incentivize vouchers and make them different amounts based on the amount of need for a child. So a child from a lower socioeconomic background might get more funding in their voucher to ideally make them more attractive to serve them. Or you can reward schools if they have a more inclusive environment. And there have been some examples of what are called intentionally diverse charter schools. But you could use policy to back that up and reward schools that reach certain thresholds and inclusion. I tend to be more cynical or skeptical about those ideas, because what you've done here with these types of policies is really elevated self-interest, and not just for families, but also for schools. And they tend to find ways around regulation. They've been incentivized to do so. And so that, they look for ways that they can get more advantages for their school. And if that includes serving more segregated populations, that's what they'll do.
Given the landscape that we're in, the policy landscape, there are a number of conservative state legislatures around the country that are bullying through voucher programs across the country. There are also Democratic-led legislatures and governors that have talked increasingly about voucher programs and the benefits that they might offer. Given this policy landscape, what recommendations would you have for policymakers, or alternatively, would you have for stakeholders who want to fight these kinds of policies and programs?
Yeah, that's a excellent question, especially how you framed it as far as it being kind of rammed through legislatures, which is true. And that's partly because there's some very well-organized interest groups that are pushing this in different states. And there is an ideological alignment of the idea of less government involvement, more freedom of choice, that aligns with the purported, positions of the Republican Party, for example. You're right, there are some Democratic legislatures that express an interest. I think Illinois in particular is looking at its tuition tax credit again. But yeah, it tends to be more of a red state issue, and that's partly because it's by the legislatures. So when you look at the strategies for moving this forward, it tends to be to avoid the voters. The history of vouchers in front of voters is not particularly positive. Voters tend to reject these programs almost always overwhelmingly, sometimes by 2-1 margins. So in places like Arizona, for example, you see legislators making efforts to go around any kind of referendum on the issue and just do this by legislative fiat, which isn't illegal. I mean, it's just a strategy, but it reflects the idea that these are not necessarily the popular programs that they suggest that they are. So I think, yeah, that's going to be the way that these things move forward. It's going to be tending to be through lobbying and legislative action. And it kind of sets up a strategy that, opponents of vouchers might want to pursue is putting this in front of voters, which is not always easy to do, but it tends to be a more winning strategy for them. The other thing is, I think that voucher skeptics need to really focus on what the evidence suggests. What is the evidence telling us about the effectiveness of these programs and the costs, and get that in front of their local representatives. Even some conservative lawmakers who like the idea of choice and vouchers get worried about the question of how much are these programs actually costing. And they tend to be, the estimates of what they will cost tend to be rapidly underestimated. And the costs have been pretty substantial. And that's partly because this isn't just a matter of programs designed to help kids in quote unquote underperforming public schools as they were originally pitched. Increasingly, it's turning into a middle-class subsidy for families who already have kids in the private schools. And when the state comes along and offers to take that cost off their hands, of course they're going to do it. So, it's increasingly serving what you could call private school families who are going to go there anyways. and it's putting the burden for the tuition on the taxpayers instead of the families, which is, you know, putting quite a burden on the public treasury as well. So I think looking at those questions of cost is also an important thing to do, and outcomes. You know, remind policymakers how these programs were originally pitched, what was the objective for them, and ask, are they meeting those goals? And in fact, you know, as evidence suggesting, they're actually a lot of evidence that they're, you know, causing substantial harm to kids in these programs, like, you know, at jaw-dropping levels in some cases.
In the second part of this month's podcast, we interviewed Dr. Suzanne Eckes, who's a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In particular, Dr. Eckes studies the impact of vouchers on equity and access and justice in schools for students and teachers. So from a legal perspective, what would you say are the key constitutional considerations and challenges associated with K-12 school voucher programs?
Well, that is a great question, and there's so much to say about that. But I'm going to take us back in time to 2002. I think that's a really important time. Well, there are many important milestones with the voucher movement that are interesting to discuss. But I'm going to go back to 2002 because you're asking about constitutional issues. And there was a very big U.S. Supreme Court case at that time. It's the Zelman v. Simmons-Harris case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was examining the constitutionality of voucher programs to begin with. So it was focused on the voucher program in Ohio. And there was a lot of controversy around vouchers at that time. Like, are they perhaps violating the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, of the First Amendment, by having arguably public money being used in one way or another in private religious schools? So the U.S. Supreme Court found that this voucher program in Ohio did not violate the Establishment Clause, and it was a 5-4 decision. Ohio's program is part of the state's general undertaking to provide education opportunities to children. Government aid reaches religious institutions via individual aid recipients and not the government. So that was one of the key takeaways from that case, I think, is, you know, the argument was, well, you're violating the Establishment Clause. Public money is being funneled, in so many words, to the private religious school. But the Supreme Court almost recognized that there was almost like a circuit breaker, that the voucher was given to the parent or guardian, and that individual or that family or group of guardians would decide where that voucher would go. So it was, you know, more of the government aid is reaching the religious institution or the religious school via individual aid recipients and not the government. So that's how they distinguish it. And what was interesting, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was Chief Justice at that time, really stressed that the program in Ohio is entirely neutral with respect to religion. It provides benefits directly to a wide spectrum of people defined only by financial need and residence in a particular school district. It permits individuals to exercise genuine choice among options, public and private, secular and religious. And the program is therefore, I think the terminology he used was true private choice. So I want to stress that the program was entirely neutral with respect to religion, because I think as we continue this discussion, we can see how current controversies around voucher programs are looking at this aspect of religion and the mixing of public funds and religion in different ways than we did in 2002.
It's interesting that the program was in Ohio. It was a U.S. constitutional question. I'm wondering, how does that work, the intersection between state laws and federal laws? For example, when you think about something like the First Amendment, how might that intersect with state laws when it comes to voucher programs?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So there are plenty of state laws that have laws that mirror, whether it's the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause, that might, you know, they're worded in different ways. Some state laws at that time were even more restrictive with the money being used in a private religious school than even the you know, federal constitution. You know, it's been interesting, too, to see how this has evolved at the state level, but then it's also circled back most recently to the Supreme Court again. Just last summer, there was a very important, or I guess 2 summers ago, there was a very important U.S. Supreme Court case, again, addressing a voucher issue. And this one was in the state of Maine, originated there. And I don't know how familiar you are with Maine's voucher program. It's not a typical voucher program. So Maine is sparsely populated. They're very, very rural areas. And so Maine, the state of Maine, would give money to families who are in these sparsely populated areas a voucher. Maine really wanted instruction in these private schools to mirror what was happening in public schools. So they wanted the students attending these schools to experience the same type of education in similar ways as a student in a traditional public school. So they would like to see, of course, math, and science, and social studies, English, and foreign language, and not have, let's say, religious instruction for 5 of the 7 hours of the day. So two sets of parents filed a lawsuit because they wanted their children to attend a private religious school that was not eligible for Maine's tuition assistance program, or in other words, their voucher program. So those defending the state policy raise concerns that these schools discriminate on the basis of sex. They discriminate against non-dominant religions. And this would include LGBTQ plus students were being discriminated against, and mandated religious participation in the schools. You know, they were arguing that this was problematic. And Julie Mead and I had done a study, and Jessica Ullum, a graduate student at the time, who's now a lawyer, did a study in 2016 looking at the potential for discrimination in charter schools. So this particular case, Carson v. Macon, mainly raised the question around LGBTQ plus rights and non-dominant religions. But we found in our 2016 study, there's also discrimination around English learners and students with disabilities. And it ruled that when a state funds private school education, it cannot require those recipients it can't require that the recipients not use the funds for religious education. And that was a real game changer, really. And I thought it was a big deal, and I wrote a lot about it with, I think, Julie Mead and Preston Green. And I know Kevin Wellner's written on this, and Derek Black. And there was a legal scholar in California who, I don't know if legal scholar was responding to our publications or this was just something he did on his own, but he said, you know, don't be so hyperbolic about Carson v. Macon, because if you're worried about discrimination and voucher programs after this big Supreme Court decision, states still have the opportunity to pass anti-discrimination laws. Well, we live in Wisconsin. Some argue Wisconsin's a blue state. Some argue Wisconsin's a purple state. Do we have comprehensive anti-discrimination laws in our voucher program? We have a large voucher program in this state. And no, we don't. And our voucher program, the anti-discrimination law, speaks to race, color, and national origin, which is great, but it doesn't speak to other areas where students have experienced discrimination in voucher programs nationwide. And in fact, in our state, I've read that our legislature has three different times, I think it was 2007, 2013, 2015, that's just off the top of my head, stopped proposed legislation that would have prohibited discrimination in the state's voucher program. So I applaud this scholar from California who said, well, you could just pass, you know, state laws. And yes, that is great. That is a really wonderful suggestion. But if we can't pass them here in Wisconsin, so is it going to then turn out to a blue state, red state, you know, the state of Maryland? Actually, after Julie Mead and Jessica Ullman and I did our study in 2016, and we found there were not comprehensive state laws that provide protections. You know, since we did that study in 2016, Maine, during the course of the litigation, and Maryland, even before that, did pass state laws that prohibited discrimination more broadly in voucher programs. In Maryland, when they withheld money from a school that very openly, I would argue, discriminated against various students, they were sued. So some of us have argued, Preston Green and I in our most recent paper, have argued these state laws are questionable after Carson v. Macon, because Carson v. Macon seemed to really elevate religious rights. And so did several other U.S. Supreme Courts, even outside of education, whether you're looking at employment or adoption cases, running your business, you know, there are several different cases where religious rights, it's been a win for religious freedoms at the Supreme Court in the past few years. So we raised the question, we don't know the answer to it, but we raised the question, these state laws, so Maryland passed a state law, it's very comprehensive, it specifically prohibits discrimination against LGBTQ plus students, same with Maine. If a case like that ever did make it to the U.S. Supreme Court, we don't know, would the U.S. Supreme Court say, well, that's their true private choice. And that's violating their free exercise rights to practice their religion as they see fit at their private religious school. And it, you know, really goes even beyond this idea of civil rights and discrimination and voucher programs. It's beyond the students. It's the teachers as well. So I'll give you two examples from our circuit. So we're in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So a case that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, it says in Chicago, when they decide a case, when that court decides a case, it's legally binding, important precedent for us to follow in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. So there was a case not too long ago. It was against a Milwaukee Jewish day school, so private religious school, I believe that received voucher money. And the teacher had been fired after being diagnosed with a brain tumor. And she tried to initiate a lawsuit under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which a teacher in a public school or a charter school would be able to do, arguably in a charter school, would be able to do. And her claim was barred by the ministerial exception because whether it's the Americans with Disabilities Act, whether it is Title VII, which prohibits discrimination in a wide variety of areas in employment, whether it's age discrimination, race discrimination, there's something in private religious schools that it's called the ministerial exception. And so if you are performing a ministerial function at the school, which was questionable at the time, is a teacher performing a ministerial function, is a counselor who's counseling someone on, hey, here's how we do the application to get into Howard University or Harvard University. Do they fall under the ministerial exception? Are they ministers? And there's been a fairly recent U.S. Supreme Court case that has viewed the ministerial exception broadly to apply to teachers. So I want to stress that this civil rights issue, and this is where I focus most of my research on vouchers, is around equity and discrimination and civil rights, looking at both students, their civil rights in voucher programs, but also educators' civil rights in voucher programs. So that's one case from the Seventh Circuit. And there's one more, and this one's more recent. It was out of Indiana. And there was a counselor at a Catholic school, received, I think, $65 million, if I'm correct, in voucher money over a five-year period. And, you know, had been there for a very long time, very popular counselor. And as soon as she had married her longtime same-sex partner, she was relieved of her duties. And so she sued and said, you know, you're violating federal employment law under Title VII. And school officials, the archdiocese, said, no, she would fall under the ministerial exception. So it doesn't matter whether she's, you know, it's LGBTQ plus teachers or, you know, teachers who have a disability or a teacher who feels like they've been discriminated based on their age or their race, you know, that this exception applies. And so I think that's an important point to, you know, at least when I talk to my students, they are always a little surprised to hear about the ministerial exception.
If I'm a parent or a public school teacher or a policymaker or a state legislator that really loves public schools and believes in the role public schools play in our society, and I said, Dr. Eckes, what do I do? What recommendations would you give to stakeholders? What kind of laws would you encourage them to advocate for, or cases would you argue they should file?
Okay, that is a great question. It's almost like we set this up together because Preston Green and I just wrote another article and it's in press right now. He has it up on his SSRN page. And it is, we make the argument, if you want to do that, if a state legislature wants to avoid deeming charter schools to be private entities rather than public schools, we argue, we found a Supreme Court, an older, somewhat older Supreme Court case known as the LeBron case, as in, it's L-E-B-R-O-N, the LeBron case, and it's about Amtrak. It's a railroad case. But why we relied on that case in our recent publication is it talked about when you have a publicly elected or a publicly appointed board. And most charter schools do not have a publicly elected board. There are some exceptions. I just had a conversation about that at a conference, the Education Law Association conference last week about that. Few exceptions. But for the most part, charter schools do not have publicly elected boards. And so we argue in our this recent publication that's in press right now, states, you should reconsider your proposed legislation that ensures that your boards are elected, publicly appointed, because that is kind of the blueprint that you would follow out of the LeBron case without getting into the weeds too much. So we're really excited about that paper, because we think that could be a viable argument for those states that truly do want to make their charter schools public. We think that could, we argue that is one way to maybe think about settling that issue in a state.
Thank you, Drs. Lubienski and Eckes, for being on this month's podcast. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu.